You're listening to episode 16 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is the GNU World Order. My name is Claude Tu, and I think this is episode 16 of season 7. As you may or may not know, I have self-imposed seasons, as it were, of 20 episodes, so I guess we're about 4 episodes out till season 8, which, as usual, is an exciting time. It's when I regenerate, of course, come back as a completely different person, so you'll hear a completely different voice, so I'll have a different face. But other than that, it'll be the same old show, you know, GNU World Order marches on. So that's 4 episodes away. Look forward to it. But for now, we're here in Season 7, Episode 16. We're going to talk about all kinds of cool technical stuff, and GNU and Linux and, you know, Unix, stuff like that. So let's get started. As you may know, may not know, but if you may know, that I really am fond of kind of the Unix ideal, the generic Unix-ness of things, not only in computers, but in life as well. I'm not making that up. But really, Unix is very important, I think. You know, it's to some people, I guess, a quickly dated system, way of doing things. I'm sure there are a lot of subtleties and little aspects of it that need improvement as times change, of course, so you need to improve things or change things, whatever. Open to those ideas, I think those are probably good, and it's even better that people a lot more familiar with programming and systems administration are in charge of that sort of thing and not me. However, the essential, you know, at the core of it, the kernel of the idea, as it were, Unix is really important to me, and the Linux distribution that I tend toward is the one that really advertises itself and has advertised itself for a very long time, I think, as the most Unix-like of the Linux distributions. I'm speaking, of course, of Slackware. And you can hold on to that thought. So Slackware, Unix, whatever. The other side of the coin, I guess, or maybe it's not the other side of the coin, but further down the scale, the way, are the modern Linux distributions that we kind of think of. Well, I don't. I think of Slackware, but a lot of people think of, when they think of Linux, desktop Linux, you know, you've got Fedora and Red Hat and Debian and Ubuntu and stuff like that. Those are great, and the thing that is developed for those systems is package management. And I will just say that package management seems pretty brilliant to me in terms of the way that software is kind of tracked and updated and made sure that it's all up to date and that it's all working together correctly and stuff like that. It seems pretty brilliant. It might not have always seemed that way. I don't know. I mean, you keep hearing about RPM hell. You keep hearing about broken dependencies, running apt-get with, you know, ignore broken or whatever it is, or fix broken or force remove, whatever. You know, you hear about these things, and maybe you run into them, especially if you're new to a system and you're getting a feel for what you should and should not be doing haphazardly, you know, breaking things. Maybe it always hasn't been great, but I'd say right now it feels pretty much like most of those things are a finely tuned system. Again, probably not. I mean, obviously there's going to be exceptions, and there are going to be moments where you're doing something and it's just like, well, this is exactly why I don't like Linux, because this package that I just suddenly decided right now I need it right now and instantly, and I can't be bothered to troubleshoot. You know, you get into those moods, but generally speaking, I think that we're all pretty happy with the way that software is tracked and maintained and installed and uninstalled in Linux. And I think that in a lot of different ways you can look at them, you can look at that system, you know, the whole packaging system, and see that it's very, very efficient. It's efficient in so many different ways. You can install things with a couple of commands, or well, with one command, really, you know, with a couple of keystrokes. I mean, it's really, really nice. You don't have to go searching for it online. You can find what you need literally by typing in, you know, aptitude, install this, or yum, install this, or yum group install this, you know, so it's kind of neat that way. And there's a certain amount of quality assurance, I think, that you get to some degree with that as well. You know, someone has sat down and to some degree, you know, made sure that this is going to work when you launch it. I think there are probably exceptions to that sometimes, and they usually tend to be with the smaller software that no one but you is using. And even then, you know, I think usually the maintainer has at least run the thing, or if it doesn't run properly, then it's something with upstream. Very nice. I like it. It's very clever, and I think when you look at other package, when you look at other systems and see what they're doing to sort of answer the problem of how do our users easily get software and how can they find it and install it and kind of get up and running quickly. I mean, frankly, the answer seems to have been Linux, right? I mean, some people are saying, oh, you shouldn't compare a software repository on free software to the App Store or vice versa. But I mean, honestly, it's the same basic model. The App Store concept, that model, really, I mean, you can trace the lineage directly from Linux software repositories. So it's apparently a good system. It's definitely innovation. And I think I might have said this before, that sort of comparison. You know, I definitely think that Linux should probably, and we as Linux users should probably step forward and loudly proclaim, hey, that was our idea. Oh, sure, you can borrow it. You know, no problem. Don't mention it because, you know, they won't. But it's something that we should be proud of. It's an innovation for sure. So that's great. And now I'm going to rip it to shreds. So me and Deep Geek and Lost in Bronx have a server that we share, and it's just a little thing, and we use it for little trivial things that we do, you know, hosting Slacker Media for me. I use it as sort of a nice little server to be able to SSH into when I'm out in a public Wi-Fi area. You know, proxy kind of thing. It's a pretty weak server. It's not very powerful. It doesn't do much. And whatever it does, it just kind of hums along and does. One of the things that we have running on it, because it is not a terribly powerful VPS slice, is THTTPD, which you can look up online. It's a really nice little web server. So think Apache or something like that, except really, really lightweight, really, really trim and slim, and it's very efficient. You know, you can serve static web pages, basically. No PHP or anything like that. It's just HTML, flat files, and it does it quite well, and it doesn't take up a lot of resource to do it. And it's been working ever since I started Slacker Media being hosted on that server. At least a year ago now, probably longer. Yeah, definitely longer. Probably 2 years. Recently, I tried to get to Slacker Media because I needed something off of it, as I very frequently do, and found that it wasn't online. So I looked into it. A couple of weeks ago, we had done some updates on the server, and it turns out that, I guess, THTTPD is no longer maintained as a Debian package. That doesn't mean that you can't find it there, but in terms of filing bugs against it, I mean, we did file a bug against it, DB. Filed the bug against this, but apparently it is without a maintainer right now on the Debian side of things. Now, when DBeak first told me this, I thought, well, that's a real pity, but hey, isn't it great? Free software exists, and there's going to be other projects kind of coming up in the place of THTTPD. And sure enough, other projects exist that are very lightweight, and there are plenty to choose from. Then I understood after a while that it wasn't that THTTPD didn't exist anymore, it was just that it wasn't being maintained by a Debian packaging person. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Because here's a software program that exists and isn't actually being maintained by someone at Debian.org. And that's never happened to me before. I mean, Debian is famous for its multiple thousands of packages. You can get anything with just an aptitude install. I was really surprised, actually. I was actually, like, I mean, that's why I got confused at first, thinking, oh, THTTPD doesn't exist anymore. It does exist, it just doesn't exist in the Debian repositories, or it's not being maintained as a package, rather. So this got me thinking even further, and I've thought of this before, and I've just kind of thought, when you're looking to, like, one little organization to provide you with packages all neatly tied up and packaged up for you, and then suddenly they stop maintaining it, what do you do? I mean, on Slackware, I wouldn't even expect that. You know, it would just be, oh, I want this little web server, so Let me see if someone else has created an install script for it. Oh, nope, no one has. Okay, well, I'll do it myself, and then I'll install it. And then I'll have the install script sitting around in my SRC folder or wherever I keep my Slack build scripts for the next time that I need to install it, or for the other computer that I need to install it on, whatever. But on Debian, or Red Hat for that matter, it's kind of like, oh, I need a package now. I need a .deb file or a .rpm file because, or I just need to decide, okay, I'm going to install this outside of the packaging system. So it's an interesting issue because it's not like the software doesn't exist anymore. It's not like it's not being packaged at all. It's just it's not going to continue to be packaged. And if there's a bug in it, there's no one really to look after it. If there's a bug in the package itself, there's no one to look after it or fix it. And I thought that was an interesting problem. And I think that it kind of underscores, I guess, the tendency for Linux users to, I think, my perception is that there's a tendency for Linux users to not like to be reliant upon some other system, some other person, some other group, whatever, for the things that make their computers run. And I think that possibly it's all good until it hits and you're like, oh, I don't have this thing that I've been relying upon for 2 years. Suddenly, I'm being told there's a problem with it and I don't have anyone to file a bug with. No one's going to fix this. I guess it's time to learn the .deb format now. And that's the one format so far that I have personally, well, not the one, but it's the big one that I have not learned. You know, RPM, I can muddle my way through. Slack builds, I can usually do. A port on BSD, I can usually do. .deb, I don't really know a whole lot about, comparatively. And so it would be something that if I was going to really invest a lot of crucial services running on Debian, I would probably want to know that. And that, I guess, is the point of this whole thing. It's that if you're running something and you don't know how to package your own software for that system that you're running, then you might want to just kind of stop for a moment and ask yourself whether that's something that you're going to really, if that's something that you would be empowered if you knew. I don't know that it's essential because, I mean, I admit I've been running Debian server for 2 years, although I haven't really been running it myself. DeepGeek has really done most of the maintenance. But I've been doing servers on Debian here at my job, and I haven't needed it up until now. But it is one of those things that when it happens to you, it's kind of, you really do stop and you think, maybe this is something that I should be looking into now before something even worse happens. Or something more, maybe not worse, but something more urgent, I guess, happens. Something to think about. And that's kind of how I'm tying this back to the opening, which is the Unix-ness of your system. And in a very real way, I think, part of the way that you manage your system in a very pure Unix fashion is whether or not you, the administrator and the sort of simultaneous dumb user, can you actually administer it? Can you hammer out a shell script to make sure that your software is cleanly and safely installed? And by that, I'm not really talking about security. I'm just talking about like whether you're going to be able to upgrade that software cleanly when it needs to be upgraded because of like a security update or some kind of important update that you just want because it's got a cool new feature that you've been dying for. So know thyself, well, know thy computer, and learn how to package something. Hey, big important packages that require 30 different dependencies and stuff like that, yeah, might not be the one that you want to start off with. But just learning to package something, some small script, even if it's a hello world thing, just learning that, the structure and sort of the build environment, if you need a specific build environment, learning that is a very empowering thing. And coincidentally, I have a packaging set of packaging tutorials that I did on Hacker Public Radio. So feel free to hunt those down. I think it became a mini-series over on Hacker Public Radio. And I do. I cover Slack builds, BSD ports, and RPM, if I recall correctly. So those are three fairly major packaging formats that you could probably maybe borrow from or learn from. So check those out and, you know, just keep in mind your packaging formats because what happens when it all goes away? All right, so go learn that, and let's talk about some other stuff. Christian wrote me an email, this is feedback, I guess, about GNOME 3, and I will officially say that this is the first negative thing that GNU World Order has to officially say about GNOME 3, if it's true. I mean, this is from an email, I haven't tried it myself, but I'm assuming it's true. That is that GNOME 3 has, well, first of all, I guess 3.4, the latest greatest, has they've released the Evolution browser, web browser, to the masses now. So it's back. I don't remember seeing it in previous versions, so I'm assuming that it's back. Maybe I just never noticed it, but I believe it's sort of like back now in 3.4. Now, one of the things that it has, like so many browsers do, is the ability to search from its little toolbar thing, and I guess it defaults to Google. Not really surprising, you know, that does tend to happen, but some people don't want to use Google, and it turns out that you, I guess, cannot change it from within its own interface. You have to go out into, I guess, something called dconf, which you have to kind of set as the controlling underlying registry slash whatever you want to call it for GNOME 3. So that was a little bit almost disturbing to hear, and I guess even more so is that, like, if you go into the application, like the activities window, you know, where there's this overlay and you see all your applications and stuff like that. Well, one of the things that you can do is search the internet from that interface. And, of course, the default browser there is also Google. And I guess it's not the same dconf property that controls the search for the desktop versus the search for the Evolution. And the bottom line is that there is no apparent way, and that doesn't mean there's not a hack that people just don't know yet, but there's no obvious way to change the search engine from Google to something else. This kind of opens up, I don't know, a big old can of worms that, frankly, I think is really good to open up. The idea of the GNOME desktop promoting Google to that extent is just, it's almost, I don't know, to me personally, it's mind-boggling. I know a lot of people just don't really care that much, and I respect that. But to me, it seems kind of surprising for a free desktop environment, a free software desktop, to hard code Google in as their search engine. If you're okay with that, then just stop for a moment and imagine your outrage when you find out that Microsoft has hard coded in, I don't know, Bing for one of their search providers, which I don't think they're even allowed to do. I think, and I don't believe Google was allowed to do that on their Chrome browser. I believe that they were told that they had to give the user a choice at startup whether they would use Google, Yahoo, or Bing as their search engine provider. So it's not done, you know, it's just not done. That's not how we've decided the rules are laid down. I don't know where these rules come from. I don't really know the justification for them, but I certainly kind of like them. And the idea that I would have the flexibility to choose a different search engine, I feel, is important. And to obfuscate that is, I think, bad enough, and to make it apparently not even possible to do, and I'm sure there's going to be something that you can do on the desktop to change that provider. I mean, somehow, there's got to be a way to do it. I mean, obviously there's a way, right? It's free software. You could download all the source code, re-hard code it to something else, and then compile the GNOME desktop for yourself. But making it that difficult, promoting just one search engine who obviously makes a lot of money off of this sort of thing, it's kind of weird. It's kind of surprising. I don't know, maybe it's just me and Christian who even care about it. Yeah, personally, I can't see myself using that. I hadn't noticed this, by the way. Mainly because, like I say, Evolution web browser is either brand new to 3.4 and I haven't used that version yet, you know, 3.4, or maybe it's been there just not in the Fedora releases that I've used, or maybe I've just not bothered installing. I don't know. So I never noticed it in the browser because I don't use Evolution typically, well, ever so far. And I haven't noticed it in the desktop because I don't remember ever implementing an online search from the activities, unless it was by accident. And I do remember seeing Wikipedia on there, which I thought was a little bit strange too, because it just gives, to me, seeing things like that it just gives Wikipedia so much credit, so much credence, you know? It's just like, oh, here's Wikipedia. Why wouldn't you want that as your default search, you know, sort of informative search online? You know, because there's just this gradual and unstoppable tendency toward, oh, well, Wikipedia says it, so it must be true, which is just so blatantly ridiculous, you know? You don't even know who's written this stuff on Wikipedia. I'm not saying it's not a good source of information, I'm not saying it's not a cool project, but I am saying that it says something, I think, when you see these buttons on your desktop that just kind of default to these things. They become kind of just these weird, latent defaults, and our brains just start to accept it. And it is a little bit strange. And to make it not something that a user can configure, I mean, I realize they're going for simplicity. I even admire that in many different ways on different levels. But there's such a thing maybe as going too far with some of these aspects. And I think, especially when you're promoting outside things from your own desktop, I think you have to be really careful there. You know, I mean, if GNOME developers want to get rid of the logout menu item, okay, that's great. That's their environment. That's what they're doing, and that's within their own environment. But when you start promoting things that you have no control over, I think it gets to be kind of dangerous pretty quickly, because maybe even the GNOME developers, I mean, maybe they love Google right now. Maybe they love Wikipedia, but it could change. Those two things could totally change. I guess then GNOME developers could just change the search providers that they utilize on their desktop. But I don't know. For me, it seems a little bit strange, and apparently for Christian as well, because that's what he emailed me about. So that's about all the listener feedback, I think. As I so often do, I will now pillage a little bit of overheard conversation in IRC. This one is a really, really interesting link that The Last Known God dug up. It was in response, I think, to someone asking about the free command, F-R-E-E. Now, if you've ever run free, that shows you the amount of memory that your system is running. And it looks deceptively self-explanatory. You look at the results of free, and it looks like it looks like you don't need to look into how to read it. It looks very straightforward. It says free. The first the table headings say total used free shared buffers cache whatever, and then the next line down says mem, M-E-M as in memory, and under total it might say something like, oh, I don't know, let me actually just run that command right now. So I did free space dash m, and on my system it states that there's 2969 total, used 2688, and free is 280. Now frankly, that seems, first of all, it does seem very self-explanatory, right? It's free is almost, you know, 3,000 megabytes, so 3 gigs. Used is 2688, and free is 280. If you look at that, you think, okay, that's my system. Well, if you look at that, you'd be wrong, because apparently, and if you go to this link, you'll find out the full story much better than I can explain it, but it's linux8myram.com. Yes, linux8myram.com. All spelled out, all one word. It's a great little site. It's one page, really. It's here's the deal on how Linux uses and reports on RAM usage. Just to break it down quickly, although, again, you should really go to this page. It's one of the rare internet web pages that just, it serves one function. It is exactly to tell you how Linux uses RAM. It does that in about 2 or 3 page scrolls, four page scrolls, that's it. And it's done. That's what it does. It conveys the information, and it's over. It's so beautiful. Please go to this page. It's so straightforward, and it's so useful to know. Because at a glance, again, that the results of that free command seem pretty good. It's like, okay, I'm happy. So I got 3 gigs total. I'm using 2.6 of it. I have 280 megabytes free. Okay, cool. Wait a minute. 280 megabytes free? All I'm doing is running one program. I've got Audacity running. Well, and a terminal, and a couple of others. But, I mean, not 2.6 gigabytes of RAM worth. This is ridiculous. Linux just ate my RAM. No, it didn't. So the actual answer, and again, if you read the page, you'll understand all of this stuff a lot better than I can explain, but it's essentially, it's reporting on how much RAM it sees as available to itself to use for applications, and it lumps all that into quote-unquote used category. So what you really need to be looking at is the minus plus buffers cache results, which will tell you that the actual RAM being used right now is 609 megabytes, and the RAM that is, you know, we could say it's spoken for, but it's not actually full of stuff, is 2.5, no, 2.3.5 5'9" or something like that. I can't see it from where I'm sitting. But it's a lot different than what you're... It's almost the complete inverse of the line above, where it says, oh, we're using 2.6 gigs of your RAM right now, and you've only got 208 megabytes free, as opposed to, well, we understand that we have about 2.5 gigabytes available to us, and we will kind of earmark it as available RAM. But in real life, like if you looked at the little bits inside of those chips, you'd only see 609 megabytes of them. So, very, very informative, very great thing to know. If you've ever used the free command, then you should absolutely read this page, because it just breaks it down for you really quickly. It's very large print. It's not an afternoon read. It's more like, oh, I have 5 minutes. Let me scroll through this little page and read up on how Linux uses my RAM. It's very, very informative. It's something you're going to want to look at and learn. And that way, just, you know, the next time some noob comes around and asks you why their system is so slow, and you look at the free command and you're pointing out all these things, well, you'd be wrong. So now you'll be right when you diagnose things. So check it out. Well, I think it's time for coffee. In fact, I know it's time for coffee. So go make yourself a cup. Come right on back and we'll finish up the show. Alright, so it's coffee time, so you're sitting back with your coffee, I'm sitting back with mine. I want to actually kind of take it back to the beginning of the show again and talk about those nasty old packages, but in a different way. So I was browsing the Slackware mailing list or the Slack Builds mailing list, one of the two, and there's an email in there about a week ago now that was talking about a new set of tools called SBO_tools, and it's a set of shell scripts that sort of help the user interface with Slack Builds, the website. Now, if you're at all familiar with Slackware and Slack Builds, you'll know that there's already a tool that was kind of, at least among a lot of podcast listeners, famously created by Chess Griffin, called SBO-PKG. If you've heard earlier episodes of this series of this show, then you'll have heard me interview Chess Griffin about SBO-PKG in the past. You'll have also heard me giving tutorials on SBO-PKG, and if you read my fine technical book, Slacker Media, available now at slackermedia.info for free, then you'll know that there's a whole chapter on there, in there, about SBO-PKG, pretty much. It was written first initially by me and then gone over with a fine-tooth comb by Slack Magic, who is the current maintainer of SBO-PKG. So there's a tool that does this already, and it's a nice tool, it's a great tool. There's command line options for it, there's a little GUI, well, incurses interface for it. It works really well, and it really does harken back to the, like everyone says, BSD ports, because it's just, it really is, it's a lot like BSD ports, which means nothing to you if you've not really used BSD ports. You know, you're like, yes, everyone says that. What does that mean? You kind of have to try it to get a feel for it. But having tried both now, I can kind of securely say, yes, that really does feel like BSD ports. Anyway, SBO-PKG is great. No one has a problem with it. SBO_tools is this new set of shell scripts that doesn't aim anywhere as high as SBO-PKG. It's really more like a shortcut. Whereas SBO-PKG is kind of a paradigm, SBO_tools is just a bunch of little shell scripts that save you from having to type in, you know, X number of commands. You can just do it really, really quickly with one or two commands. SBO_tools and also SBO-PKG and that phrase, that sort of, oh, look at how much I know phrase of, oh, this is a lot like BSD ports, quote-unquote. Those things refer to a very specific, and they deal with a very specific way of installing and kind of tracking software, which is, you know, similar in some ways to, like Debian and probably Yum, in that they look at a repository, a remote server full of software, and they pull down a list of what's available on that server. And then when you are browsing for new software on your system, you're not actually connecting to the remote server. You're simply looking at this list, or this cached, you know, list, or a port tree, if you want to call it that, whatever. You're looking at some local version of everything that's on that on that repository, on that remote server, and then you say, okay, I'm ready to install now. And so then you type in the magical install command, whatever it might be, and then it goes out onto the remote server, pulls the package, and installs it in Debian's case. In the BSD port case, you're looking at this list of local packages. You go into the folder containing the software that you want to install, and then you run the script, and you simply say make clean install clean and execute this script, which then goes out to a remote server somewhere that contains the source code, pulls the source code down, and then installs it, compiles it, and then installs it on your system. Same goes pretty much for SBO or for Slack builds, either SBO underscore tools or SBO PKG. You're looking at a synchronized listing of what's available out there in the world. You run the script by simply doing a /foo/slackbuild, and it executes the script, which generally speaking goes out to the remote server where the source code is found, pulls that down, and installs the thing. So you've got these different methods of installing things. SBO PKG and SBO underscore tools makes a local mirror of a local, well, it's really just, it uses rsync. They both use rsync to copy the list of everything that's available at slackbuilds.org. And so that's why everyone says when they look at Slack builds, or rather, I keep saying Slack builds, I mean SBO PKG, or in this new case, SBO underscore tools, that it's very port-like, because you can navigate or look into the local directory tree. It's really just a directory tree full of a shell script for each application that then goes on to any number of remote servers, because it's not just looking at the slackbuild.org server. Well, actually, it's not looking at that at all when you compile it. It's not getting source code from slackbuilds.org. It's going to the project's homepage, wherever that might be, audacity.sourceforge.net, whatever. It's downloading the package from that project's website, bringing it down onto your computer, and then compiling it onto your computer, and then installing it into some package somewhere on your system that you can then install. Simple as that. SBO PKG happens to roll that all into one action. You can say, okay, build that, and then it will ask you, hey, do you want me to install this as well? Well, after I build it, do you want me to actually go ahead and execute the install PKG command? You can tell it yes or no if you don't want it to be automated like that. SBO underscore tools separates the activities, because that's really, they are separate activities, actually. Anyway, my point, I guess, is, well, my point, I think, started out being, hey, look, there's this cool new tool called SBO underscore tools. You should check it out if you run Slackware. That was the original point. The more I talk about it, the more I realize that this method underscores the Unix-ness of both BSD ports and Slackware, so it's the Slack builds, I guess, because you've got a consolidated system that says, here's our way of doing this thing, and it's going to be a port system, or it's going to be this Slack build system, and everything else outside of it exists in its own, you know, on its own server. You're not duplicating any effort. You're not saying, well, I know that there's an audacity.sourceforge.net out there, but we're going to package it up and roll it into this certain file format, and then we're going to put that on our server, and people can come to our server to grab that. It's not like that. It's more modular than that. And I think that's very, very cool. So that's my secondary point, is, oh, look how Unix-y that is, and how much I really like that. But before that even, if you want to check out SBO underscore tools, it's out there on the internets at github.com/nihilismus. That's nihilismus. /SBO_tools, and it's a really simple set of tools. And if you're getting into shell scripting, you might want to look at that as well, just because it's a shell script, and they're pretty simple. I looked at the SBO PKG shell script, or you know, the program, and it's just so mind-boggling to me. It is truly complex. Whereas SBO underscore tools is more on my level. So if you're kind of getting into and doing more shell scripting or whatever, you want to see some simple examples. They're kind of cool to look at, whereas SBO PKG might be a little bit advanced if you're new to it, or not so new to it in my case. But well, I mean, I'm new to it, but I mean, I've written them before. But yeah, SBO PKG is a feat of shell scripting. It's amazing. But SBO underscore tools is cool. It's also cool, of course. The tertiary point here would be that we've got, and I know everyone says it, it's so obvious and cliche if you're a Linux user and have been for a while, but man, do we have choice, and it's so, so great that people can simply say, here's Slack builds. Well, first of all, the fact that Slack builds exists at all, because, I mean, that is truly an unofficial extras repository for Slackware. You know, it's not sanctioned by Slackware, it wasn't started by Slackware, it's just Slack builds. And we can hook into that. We can make that part of our system, and many of us do. So that's there. And then you've got these tools, these tool sets that people can invent. And yes, SBO underscore tools might be duplicating some functionality of SBO PKG and vice versa. But who cares? We can do that. We have that ability and that freedom in GNU Linux because it's free software, and we can do that. That's a really powerful thing, and I think maybe it's making an extra special impact upon me this week or this month, actually, because I'm dealing with some stuff in real life for some video makers that I'm associated with where it isn't just that you're locked into the proprietary method of doing this video thing. It's that even the proprietary method won't allow them to do what they want to do because it's two different companies that don't agree on some things. And so there's just no way around it. And it's super proprietary. So far I've not found a way to sort of, or an easy way to extricate it from, you know, do the whole tricky from proprietary to free back to proprietary trick, because it's just, they're so proprietary that it's really turning into a problem. So seeing little things like this where we can just reinvent the way our software works if we want, and we do, and then someone else can come along and reinvent it again for themselves without having to break anything. It's amazing. So good going Linux, good going Slackware, and check out SBO underscore tools. It's a really fun little tool if you're using Slackware. Okay, so one last quick tip that I plundered from IRC again, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Southeast Linux Fest and stuff like that, but the tip is, well, have you ever been sitting around with, you know, configuring your router or something, for instance, and you decide that you need to make a static IP address? You know, you need to make sure that your desktop always grabs 192.168.1.2. Or a printer. You know, you want your network printer to always grab 192.168.1.3. Whatever. If you're doing that in your router, which would frequently be the place that you would on like a home or a small network where your router is also being your DHCP server. So, I mean, you could be doing this on your server as well, your DHCP server. Whatever. You're configuring something with a DHCP server running on it, and you're assigning static IP addresses. So if you've ever done that before, then you know that the typical way to do that process is to get the MAC address of the interface card, the network interface card, of that computer, and hard code that MAC address to be given specifically some IP address in your dhcpd.conf or whatever little GUI interface your router provides for you to do that with on. So that's how you do it, right? So obviously that involves you getting the MAC address from that computer, from that destination computer, or that target computer, I guess, was what it would be. Typically, in the past, when I've been doing this, it has been a very interactive process, because I'm configuring a friend's router at their house, and I'm trying to make sure that in the future I can get to their computer if I need to be helping them online, you know, when I'm SSHing into their network or something to help them with their computer. I want to make sure that their computer is in a location that I can easily SSH to, or I want to forward, port forwarding to directly into that computer, something like that. Or I am setting up a person's computer at work, but I'm sitting in front of their computer and deciding, okay, I think I'll give this person a static IP for some reason, and so I'll just SSH over to the server and input their information. So it's been like a very interactive thing where the MAC address is on the same computer that I am on, or the MAC address is on the computer that is sitting right next to me. I could see a scenario where that wouldn't be the case, where I would want to configure that computer, and I it's not in the same room, and I don't want to get up and go find that computer and look up the MAC address and stuff like that. So if you're ever in that situation, if you're in a situation where you need to know the MAC address of a computer on a network without having to go to that computer and physically looking at it, you know, typing in ifconfig and then finding the MAC address in that report, then the way to do that, well, is twofold. There are two commands, and it's a lot easier than you would think. You might think that, you know, your brain, like if I asked, as actually 330 on IRC did, that's 330 is a name, not a time in this case, but asked, how can I do this? You know, my brain personally kept thinking, okay, well, it's got to be TCP dump somehow. I just need to figure out the switch in TCP dump that will get me the MAC address, you know, some kind of verbose thing, and then maybe figure out how to parse that to make it easier to read, and then I'll have it. Or, you know, maybe Wireshark or something like that. Or InMap. Surely it would be an InMap if we knock on enough ports on InMap and figure out, do OS detection and do everything that we can possibly do, surely it'll be there. None of the above. I mean, maybe. I don't know. I didn't really check. But it's really simple. You ping the computer that you want the address of. So let's say we're trying to find out the current MAC address of a computer that we know is located at 192.168.1.4. Ping the computer. Once or twice is enough. You don't have to ping it constantly. Just send a ping out to it. And then simply in the command line type in the command ARP. A-R-P, that is, ARP. You'll have to be root, so run ARP as either sudo or su-c or whatever root kind of escalation you prefer. Run ARP, and you'll see the cached ARP table of your system, which will include anything that you're either connected to right now or that you've just pinged. Because it's basically a cache. It's the ARP cache of your session. In my case right now, if I ping 192.168, for instance, 168.1.1, it's the main server, then I get back the hardware type that computer is connected via, so in this case it's the Ethernet card, and then the HW address, which of course is the hardware address, the MAC address, and which interface I'm looking at. If it's a multiple interface computer, which in that case it actually is, and that's it. That's you get the MAC address, you get a little bit of detail about the box that you're looking at and how it's connected, and the problem is solved. So next time you're looking for that sort of information, send a couple of pings out, get MAC addresses back. Astonishingly easy. By way of giving credit where credit is due, I believe, again, it was 330 who asked the question, and I think it was Claudio who spoke up first with the correct answer. So Claudio from, you'd know Claudio from Linux Basement, what used to be Linux Basement. So that's how I got this information. I can't tell you enough, and I was just actually, I was eating lunch, strangely enough, with Integral, who you might know from Tech Misfits, and we were talking, I'm not kidding either, we actually went to lunch. It's really, I know it's, you're probably like, wait, how do podcasters do lunch? Well, strangely enough, Integral was in the same town as I was in, and so we had lunch together. It was really weird. And we were talking about IRC in general, and we both kind of had the same thought at the same time. We were just like, IRC is such a useful place to be. It's really sublimely so. Like, I don't think to myself each morning, oh, I'd better log into IRC. Well, primarily because it's always running in a screen session, but I don't, you know, look at my IRC window thinking, gee, I wonder what I can learn today. But I find that if you sit there and just kind of leave it open long enough, and you don't always even have to speak, I mean, it's fun if you do, but just idling, you'll learn so much. I mean, sometimes you'll learn the wrong thing, you know, you'll learn mistakes, you'll learn answers that weren't correct to a problem, but I mean, that's validly learning something. And other times you'll just find cool little shortcuts or tips and tricks that you just wouldn't even really thought to ask about, you know? And I think that's the kind of the advantage of it. A lot of times the problem in learning something new at certain stages in Linux, but probably in life as well, but you know, the problem is that you don't know the question to ask. You not only do you not know the answer, you just don't even know what question to ask in order to learn something new. But in IRC, sometimes you get the benefit of other people who know just enough to ask a question, and then you get the benefit of the smarter people answering correctly, and now you've learned not only the right question but the right answer. Very powerful thing. So if you don't go to IRC often, check it out. Feel free to check it out. People are totally friendly in there, and you really, really might learn something. Last but not least, speaking of learning things and friendly people, Southeast Linux Fest. It is mere weeks away at this point. It really is. It's, you know, if I really was a good, like, proper reporter type person, I would have looked up dates and things like that. I don't know the dates, but they're soon. They're in June, and right now, in real time, it's May, I think. So it's very, very soon. But Southeast Linux Fest, of course, I mean, it's Southeast United States of America, so if you're not in United States of America, it would be a long trek, but probably not as long as it is for Peter 64, who will actually be there at Southeast Linux Fest in person, making an appearance to all of his United States listeners. So that's going to be really neat. But even outside of Peter 64 being there, which is very exciting if you're a Kernel Panic or a Linux Crank or a Tit Radio listener, then you'll know Peter 64 certainly. If you're listening to me, you probably know who Peter 64 is. But yeah, so he'll be there, and Southeast Linux Fest itself is just very, very unique. I guess it must just be the lineage of a fest, of who puts it on, who makes it happen, kind of the core group in the center of that fest. They must really have some kind of effect on how that festival comes across, and I don't know that much about putting on events, but you do get this weird sense that Southeast Linux Fest is different. It's a unique thing, and it's unique in a lot of different ways. I mean, it's got a lot of people who come to it, and a lot of them are from the South, so you have a sort of a cultural flavor there that if you're not from the South of the United States, then it's very, very different, you know. I mean, to people not in the South in the U.S., it's a very unique experience. It's like it's almost as if though I was going to France, you know. It's completely different, except that I understand a little bit more of what they're saying when I'm there than I would in France. Actually, that might be a toss-up. But seriously, you know, I mean, the local community there has its own little cultural feel, which is cool to experience. And the festival itself, they just pack so many talks in. The first time they did this, I think it was the second year, they really just went almost overboard with the talks. They just had so many talks to choose from. And it kind of annoyed me a little tiny bit the second year. You know, I thought, well, this is just too much. There's too much here. And it's kind of silly to cram that much into one festival. And now that I'm going to festivals lately, like within the past year, I'm going to festivals in a different mindset. And it's the different mindset of, I actually do, like, computer stuff, I mean, IT stuff specifically, for a living now. I kind of need to know a whole... I'm in the market now for a different set of knowledge, you know? I'm not in it just to hear cool words bandied about. I actually have things that I have questions about that I want to learn. And so I can attend talks with a different purpose in mind, which is new to me, you know? I mean, I've always enjoyed technical talks, but now it's got, like, this weird edge to it where I want to go to a talk and actually learn something, which, again, it really is kind of new to me to have such a clear idea of what I need to know rather than, I don't know what I need to know, I just need to know everything, so give it to me. Give everything to me. So going to Southeast Linux Fest with so many talks, so much to choose from, is actually a benefit, because now I know exactly what I need to know from this conference, and I know exactly the talks, and I can choose, you know, just the talks that I want to go to. And if there's, I mean, there's not going to be an hour block where there's nothing for me. Every hour is going to have at least one talk that I want to see because I want to try to implement, you know, this or that technology for some reason. So I think maybe depending on where you are in sort of your state of, okay, here's what I need to know, this could be a really great conference. And even if you were, if you're more like I was before this job that I got in IT, then you're still going to learn a lot because there's just so much there going on, and you can just sit in on any talk, and it's just, it's incredible stuff. Incredible presenters, a huge Slackware representation, and by huge, I mean 5 or 6 people huge. I'm talking more than one Slackware user is going to be at this conference, which, you know, that's a lot. So, yeah, Southeast Linux Fest, it's a lot of fun. It's got a lot going for it in a lot of different ways, you know, just not only the technology, but also just kind of it being in the South and having that Southern charm to it that you sort of hear about. So yeah, Southeast Linux Fest, very, very soon. I'll be giving a talk there on Qtractor, so if you want to learn more about Qtractor, you can listen to me. I'll be at Hacker Public Radio booth, I think, which is going to be sharing, I think, with the Tilts booth. I'm not really sure. I'm doing the program guide right now in Scribus, of course. So that's being done by me on free software, so rest assured, they're not doing it on Adobe, don't worry. Yeah, I don't know. It's cool. I would definitely, if you've not been, you want to go to Southeast Linux Fest at some point. If you can't make it this year, then just, you know, pencil it in next year. It should be around the same time, June, July, whatever. And it's a lot of fun. I think you'd really enjoy it if you like Linux, because these festivals are just kind of all about Linux. And there's usually people to talk to, too. So you'll probably end up making, you know, new friends or whatever, so Southeast Linux Fest, very, very soon. Check it out at probably southeastlinuxfest.org or something. I'm not sure. Just look for it online. It's there. That's about it for this show. Thank you for listening. My name is Klaatu. This has been the GNU World Order. You can find GNU World Order online at gnuworldorder.info. You can find me on Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. That's instant messaging. You can find me on IRC a lot, too. I'm on the IRC, the Freenode IRC network, so irc.freenode.net in your IRC client. And you can join the Ogcast Planet channel or Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others that I'm usually in. Open Source Musicians is a good one, so I'm around there. And you can also, of course, email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
You'll see very soon.